As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck. I'm Alex Lowe and the referee for today's episode, so controversial decisions are guaranteed, and if anyone starts yelling at me, I'll just become more and more dismissive. Fortunately, I'm joined today by the referee whisperer, Sam Warburton, the former Wales and Lions captain. Lawrence Dallaglio, the former England captain who's never whispered anything in his life, also joins us, along with Owen Slott, the loudmouth rugby correspondent for The Times. Gents, we have plenty to discuss. Wales for the Grand Slam. What's Warren Gatland looking for in a Lions captain? And which member of the France setup is for the guillotine? But first, Sam, happy St David's Day. I bet it's particularly happy down with you. And how are we all?
Yeah, good. I had the carnage this morning of getting the little ones dressed up in rugby tops and Welsh ladies outfits and things like that. So I've got toothpaste all over me now, so I just got in the nick of time after the preschool carnage. But no, all good, thanks. Yeah, very good.
You look pretty good in your Welsh ladies outfit. I didn't know we were all supposed to wear one of those today. How was Cardiff for you guys?
Oh, it was... I mean, it always delivers, doesn't it? You know, Wales, England always delivers. And I can understand like so much of the frustration. And I'm sure you guys are the same. Like, you know, your Twitter feeds, social media feeds have been going crazy with people who are disagreeing. But I guess that's the beauty of rugby, isn't it? Like, it's so hard to, and the Six Nations, it's so hard to predict what's going to happen. I did not see Wales 3-3. I'll put my hand up, I'll be honest. I think I predicted them to come fourth. So it just showed, you know, I wouldn't have thought Scotland would have won on week one. And but that's what's great. We were here, weren't we, like about 4 weeks ago, and we said there's always going to be an upset. Like, there's always an upset, and there's been more than I expected already. So it's been a great tournament from that perspective. We don't know what's going to happen. So, yeah, you said then, you know, Welsh Grand Slam. My first thought is, well, no. But then what? Like, it could be. Like, we don't know. It could be. Like, who knows what's going to happen with France, which we'll dive deeper into, whether they're going to have to end up giving points or... Like, who knows? So yeah, it's on the table for sure.
Slaughter, you were down there and you had a ringside view. The press box in Cardiff is about four rows back from the edge of the pitch. What was your perspective on the game? And I guess we ought to go sort of straight into the first 20 minutes really, and those big decisions that got made.
Well, I love the Principality Stadium. I think it's the best rugby stadium there is. It's the most atmospheric. But actually, the where the press box is one of the worst, because you're right down on almost on ground level. So you get no perspective. It's quite hard to see the way the players, the movement on the pitch. But on Saturday, because there was no crowd, you were so close, you could hear absolutely everything that was going on. And then there was just this consistent din throughout the match, this strong Wigan accent going, "Go on, smash him, Curry, smash him, Curry." And that was Owen Farrell from beginning to end. It just managed to deliver more than any other game that I think I've watched since we've been in empty stadia. I really sort of had that sort of edge of seat kind of, this is really exciting. On the refereeing, I wrote in the Times this morning that the ref got both big decisions wrong, but England lost the game in the last quarter. That was where it went. It wasn't in the start.
Do we even need to discuss the decisions, or do we all agree that Gauzin managed the situation wrong for the first one and the second one was a knock-on?
Well, we sort of need Jonesy, don't we?
Can't quite understand how Stephen Jones has come up with the temerity to defend the referee and say that not only were they hardly even controversial, but he got both decisions right. Really, they're offering you in the press box to drink over the game. I mean, England started the game by giving away penalties, and that is the big problem with England at the minute, the way they start test matches, you know, I know that there's no crowd, etc., but when they lose, there's a pattern to the way that they start the game. And they invited that. This was always going to be a tight game, because if you look at England Wales over the last few years, it's been a one-score game, you know. So I just felt that Wales, they had a slight advantage just going into that game, just because the pressure was on England. And I thought they handled it well. But I think as a former captain, I'd be absolutely livid with the referee. You know, if he says to you, go and have a word with your players, you'd probably be inclined to say to him, okay, can you just make sure you give me time to have a word with the players? But Owen Farrell probably didn't think about that. He just went off and did that. And I just thought it was very disappointing, really. It's a distasteful way to concede a try, if I'm honest. And it was also the way that Pascal Gauzès spoke to him as well. You know, I mean, he sort of spoke to him like he was like he was telling off a child. And I think there lies England's problem. I said it all along. I can't understand why Eddie doesn't have a forward as a captain. I just think the modern game, particularly the way it's refereed now, decisions every few, you know, minutes or whatever, you've got to be having that little dialogue. And I'm sure, I'd love to know, Owen, whether you heard Adam Wynne-Jones talking to the referee every now and again. Probably didn't need to as much, but just the little quiet conversations. I think England's big Achilles heel, not that Owen Farrell doesn't deserve to be captain, but they need a forward as a captain. Every single major World Cup, apart from David Kirk, has been won by the tie with a forward as a captain. And it just makes such a difference.
Do you know what? I was going to jump. I completely agree, because I don't want to sound disrespectful to Owen Farrell. And I've said, and I think it's thrown it wide open now, because I'm sure we'll come on to it, with Marrow's discipline. I've always told Marrow's name in the hat, but it's not because it's, I don't think Owen's worthy. Owen's a brilliant leader. I think he's been amazing for England. He's an iconic English player. But looking what Gatland will want as well, you know, you've played with him, Lal, and you've seen him over the last 10 years. Like he always wants that forward there. Whether it's not myself, it's been Pete Romani, or it's been Adam Wynne, or it's been Ken Owens or Dan Lydiot on Lions tour. It's like he goes that forward. And it's so important to be able to get to that ref as fast as possible. But I completely agree. I think it's got to be a forward moving forward. It's just so much easier to have that dialogue with the ref.
Can I ask you two former captains, if you did make that change, because Owen's captain, but he's also, like they call him, the spiritual leader. He's so much the number one alpha male in that group that he's the de facto captain, which, you know, whether he's got the C next to his name or not. So if you did make a change and kept Owen at 10 or 12 or whatever, but made a Marrow or Jamie George captain, would that be an awkward dynamic at all, or would it actually just empower more leadership?
Like you mentioned, I think, and if Eddie Jones can look after him in this situation, he could, like, if you said, right, listen, I need a forward at captain, because I just need that constant dialogue with a referee, or not that constant, because that's not really the right thing, less is sometimes more, but more that quick dialogue. But seeing someone like Owen Farrell, like, he was an enormous leader on the two Lions tours that I've been on, and that's why I always try and bat off confidence as captain, and you'll be the same, Lal. A captain, like, you don't rule with an iron fist when you're an international captain. You've got like 6-7 lieutenants on that field with you who are as influential, if not sometimes more influential, in that game or in the training week. So, same like a Welsh perspective, there's always been like massive input from Dan Biggar and Alan Wynne-Jones and Jamie Roberts and Gethin Jenkins. Like, those boys were like coaches on the field with me. And like, sometimes I go 40 minutes and you don't really make a decision yourself, because you look at, like, when you have a penalty decision, you look at like your two or three guys, you all just have like a 10, 15 second quick consultation from 30 yards away. One of them might be looking to the corner. You all give each other the thumbs up. Somebody might then put his hand up and say, no, actually, I think this. You can have a quick discussion. It's never like a one-man band, captaincy. So if Owen didn't have it, I don't think it would be embarrassing for Owen. I think you just come out and explain, listen, Owen's not got the captaincy. We're not taking away any leadership from him. All it is just we're just changing the dynamic between player and referee. That's all it would be. So you don't want to leave your players out to dry, because I've seen that happen in the past when they switch captains. It's embarrassing. So I think it's more of a tactical thing. You know, Owen's going to be, he probably still will be England's most influential and biggest leader, even if he wasn't captain. But yeah, I just wonder whether it'll make a difference to do that.
But also, talk about changing the dynamics, Sam, between player and referee. There's a way of communicating. We see it a lot. Owen has, through his career, been criticised for the way he's communicated with referees. And he was obviously furious on Saturday over that first try. And as you said in the television box, you had also been furious. But I just wonder whether you've got no chance of winning a referee back on side if you chase him and start haranguing him. And that's what happened on Saturday. But there has been a pattern of that.
But that's the point, isn't it, Alex? That if you play 10, you've got to chase him, haven't you? Because, you know, you've got to make a positive move forwards to go and speak to him. The best time to speak to a referee is when Owen Farrell's just put a kick into touch and it's rolling down the touchline and about to go to town. You're all running towards that line out, you know, and you could have a quiet word with them. And the other, you know, millions of people watching can't even hear you. You're just having a quiet dialogue with them side by side. And I just think it's very awkward for Owen. And I agree with Sam, you know. Most the best number 10s in the world are very vocal out on the field anyway. You look at Johnny Sexton, Dan Bigger, you know, all these guys, they're instructing you all the time. And I just think he could just do with that responsibility. And dare I say it, I think it would bring out the best in him because his position in the team wouldn't necessarily be a shoo-in either. I can't stop playing in my mind that go and have a word with your team. And Owen did exactly that. And then a few seconds later, he just blew the whistle. It's not the first time Pascal Gauzet's done that, is it? I understand. And there's been other referees that have done that. But I just felt it was really, really harsh.
I had two thoughts on that. I mean, he obviously didn't give him enough time. And there's a story in Midi Olympique, the French rugby paper this morning, saying that Gauzet has spoken to Joel Jutko and confessed he did manage that incorrectly. Having said that, there is a shot from end on that shows that when time is called on and Bigger kicks it, England do have players out on one wing covering that side and not the other. And my second question is, it has happened to England before with the same fly half and the same referee. Do England bear any responsibility at all for what happened, knowing that it's happened before and that they did have one flank covered? Or is this solely the fault of bad referee management?
I did notice, I think it was it Daly? Or I think he legged it because he sort of spotted that Bigger was obviously shaping up and he looked ready to and he was obviously facing the cross field as well. But then I do think England could be held responsible in some way, in the sense that even if, I remember when we used to play against England and they had Danny Kerr and Sean Edwards would drill into us all week on every penalty, get back 10, because Danny Kerr taps and goes. I don't know how many times he'd done it against us and he scored. So you need that level of responsibility as well. So yes, and England were caught napping a little bit on Hardy's try. They were sleeping a little bit in the 22 and they didn't respond then. So there is a common theme there, but I will always defend this one. So I had a lot of Welsh people having a go at me. So you always side with England, the big calls. Like, I'm not siding with anyone. It's outrageous. What Gauzet should have done, just out of courtesy, he should have looked at England captain, got England captain, time's coming back on. And even if he just gave Owen that instruction out of courtesy, then at least Owen could just shout whatever call they've got to get in position. And at least they would have 3 seconds, 4 seconds to get in position, which is at least something, which would still be fairly harsh, but at least he's had instruction. But the way you watch it back, Gauzet almost like whispers the Dan Bigger time back on, blew his whistle as if it's like fixed almost. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was just, I just thought it was crazy. So I'll always defend that one. I'm not defending England. I'm just looking at it from a pure referee captain instruction, what you would expect as a captain. You would just expect that instruction at the times coming back on, I think.
Yeah. Isn't that the problem with one of the big problems with England right now is Lawrence, you say they've got this pattern of early conceding early penalties discipline. If you look back at England's sort of good periods, like 2019, they had this incredible record for always scoring like the first 2 or 3 or 4 minutes. And Eddie's big thing was like, you're going to come out of the block so fast and with such intensity, you're going to almost scare the opposition with the physicality and the pace you go at them. And that's produced in the good days, that's produced tries and early scores and confidence and momentum. But now it seems that they're coming out of the blocks with the same frame of mind because they think they need to create that early dominance. But in fact, what's happening is rather than creating that early success, they're being slightly frustrated and it's leading to being penalised for their excessive early intensity. It's sort of gone against them.
Well, I mean, listen, I couldn't agree more. I was a big fan of the opening 5 or 10 minutes of any test match, really, talking about what you can get away with and what you can't. I mean, England talked about, are we going down to Wales? We're going to do this one for Jack Willis. Well, if I was Jack Willis in hospital, I wouldn't have been terribly impressed with the way they started. You know, I'm going with, if that's what you mean by sort of winning this for me, then, you know, well done, lads, because, you know, you've shot yourselves in the foot there. So, you know, if you're going to talk the talk, you've got to walk the walk as well. You know, if we're doing this for Jack, then come out the blocks properly. Yeah, and look, you know, penalties are you're always going to give away penalties. I think what really frustrates, and Sam and I have given away enough penalties to know this ourselves, that if you're being stressed by the opposition or you're being played off the park, you're going to give penalties away. I get that. But a lot of the early ones, particularly that allowed Wales into the game, were just penalties that didn't need to be given away, you know, especially when you've got a referee that clearly is quite keen to blow his whistle a lot. And that was evident. And I think that's where the experience comes in. You just got to just calm down. Even, you know, especially someone like Mara, who's a brilliant player, but is borderline some of those things that he did. And, you know, you could argue if you're an England fan, maybe two of them were pretty harsh, actually, offside and slapping the ball out of scrum half's hand. Technically, it's not actually a penalty, but you just need to calm down, really, because Wales didn't have to earn their field position in that opening 20 minutes. And ultimately, they were 14 points up without actually having done very much at all. And you can't afford that in international rugby. And people said, we didn't have an effect on the game because it got back to 24 all. But actually did have an effect on the game. It had a massive effect because the picture that had been painted in that opening 20 minutes was such a bad one to the referee, despite his controversial decisions, that England never recovered from it.
I thought England played some of their best attacking rugby that we've seen really since the World Cup, probably. In patches, they seem to have moved away from this mindset of trying to play without the ball, to just kick everything and apply pressure, and trusted their ball carriers and their skill players to create the openings. And there were, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 opportunities that they created, and some of them they blew with poor execution, some was good defence and turnovers, and some were wrong decisions. But there were also some really encouraging moments, which I know they talked about afterwards, and that's the one thing they will grip onto going into the France game, just the interplay between forwards and backs, the speed of ball that they generated. And that led to points, it led to tries, and it helped them get back to 24 all with that Ben Youngs try. And at that point, I'm thinking England have got a role here. They can empty the bench and that they'll probably win it from here. And then as Owen, as you said in the paper today, that was the quarter that really lost them the game.
Yeah, games are won and lost in the final quarter of a match. It's especially in Six Nations tight games, that's where one stretches ahead. And yeah, I thought at 24 all, the momentum was all England's. They caught up with Wales twice. If you're a psychologist looking at the game, you'd say, well, Wales are probably slightly wondering if they've had their chance, and England will be thinking, well, we're on a roll here. Just going back to the conceding of penalties, and when you, as Lawrence said, you know sometimes under stress you do it. Though they gave four penalties away in those last 17 minutes, and not one of them was necessary. Not one of them was because Wales was so pressurizing them that there's nothing else they could do. Or whatever, they were all just foolish, silly mistakes. You know, people not thinking correctly under pressure. God, did I really say that? Yeah, I just
more mug than teacup, I think. Really,
yeah, good point. But the other thing is you're saying you know the experienced Wales team sort of saw their way through it. This is about as experienced an England team as you ever get. I mean, they're always around the 800 cap mark. Most of the team have got 50 caps or more. I mean, Marrow, the chief offender, is up to about 46, I think now. So it's like, you know, what point do you
know? I think the, you know, the three penalties that gave, I think Charlie Yules, Dan Robson and Ellis Genge. And it wasn't until later on in my career, in the 2007 World Cup, when I spent quite a bit of time off the bench. And I used to come on in the last 20 minutes of a test match. And I was so, so nervous and conscious about, you know, in a tight game. I remember the Australia quarterfinal in particular in Marseille, where you just think to yourself, you know, do not be the one that gives a penalty away that allows this team to win the game. Maybe that comes from hindsight of having, I don't know, 60, 70 caps under your belt already. But I just thought the bench, unfortunately, you know, did not give England the lift that they wanted. And, you know, fair play to Callum Sheedy. I think he deserves a mention because he had an off day, you know, a couple of weeks previously. And actually, when Dan Bigger had gone off, was that a tactical? Was it just that he couldn't shake off an injury at half-time?
Yeah, it looked like an injury, yeah.
And I actually thought that might be could have been a turning point for Wales. But, you know, fair play to Callum Sheedy. I mean, they showed a lot of bottle to nail those three kicks and really take them out of sight.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Warren Gatland was in the stadium in the corporate box watching on. You know, one of his jobs would have been to run the rule over captaincy contenders. Owen Mara, we talked about. Alan Wynne-Jones, of the three, probably, well, definitely emerged from the day on top. What do you think is in Warren's little notebook at the moment about the shape of the squad and the kind of identity of the captain and the influence that that person could have over the tour?
I think most people will probably think, oh, it's going to be a really tricky one. But the only thing is, I don't want this to sound like the Sam Warburton show, but I'm going to say a story which will explain what I'm on about. So if we went to 2013, which I was captain for that Lions tour, but if going into round four of the Six Nations, I would have been nowhere near it because the first game I remember I played against Ireland, I was just okay, but I got injured. So I you know, didn't pull up any trees. I just did normal game, got injured, didn't play in round two. Round three, then I came off the bench against Italy for like 20 minutes. So like, what can you do? Do you know what I mean? So I was going into round four, nowhere near a contender for Lions captaincy, nowhere near. So the only thing I'll say is, with the last two rounds, which is where it's all going to happen, a lot can change. You know, like you could have, like Stuart Hogg, I think has been brilliant, mind. And I know it's all about forwards being captains, but if you're looking at one person who at the minute looks like he's going to be a shoe-in. The only thing I know Warren Gatland to be keeping his eye open for massively will be his defensive qualities. That's the only thing that's, I think, held him back. He always says that you need a captain who needs to be a starter. But if you're looking at a starter, if you're looking at back three, I thought Josh Adams was impressive yesterday, but I think Watson, Hogg, and they're the only two shoe-in back three players, I think, at the minute. I think the other position is wide open for, you know, Van der Merwe, Zammit, Josh Adams, me. Like those guys are on the fringes, but
Liam Williams.
Yeah, Liam Williams. You got those guys, you got that sort of group of six. But as starters, I think Watson and Hogg are shoo-ins at the minute, from what we've seen. So my point is a lot can change in this last two rounds. And like, you know, Owen could have two magnificent games in the last two rounds and then be front runner. But I think what's going to hurt him, it's just like the lack of rugby that those Sarries boys have had, it makes a difference. So I heard Jamie George say, oh, we've treated it like a pre-season. I went into both Lions tours off the back of 2-3 months off because I got injured before both tours. I tell you, it's a nightmare. And I only just got fit for the test matches in the nick of time. And luckily, I had a head coach who knew it took me 2 or 3 games to get back to the top level. And he had a bit of faith in me and I managed to get back to that level. But I think I'm not sure you can be a captain of a Lions when you're not going to play rugby for potentially 3 months at top level. They've got to look at like a short-term loan or something, because there's a statistic. I wonder whether this is why England haven't... I thought two games would be enough for England to get rid of the cobwebs. Adam Beard yesterday, who started for Wales Saturday, 2 days ago, had more minutes under his belt this season, and he hadn't particularly been overplayed, than the whole England pack put together. Like, surely... I remember thinking, I'm not going to use that pre-match, because if England win, it's just one of those stats that's just like, you know, just one of those things. You get all these fancy stats which come pre-match. But if England lose, I think then it suddenly has a bit more weight to it, because it just shows that like the penalties and the lack of physicality that we're seeing from England compared to before, it's having an effect. It's having a massive effect. So I do think that England's players need to play more rugby in between campaigns because they're not rolling into internationals like they used to be.
A couple of things on the captaincy, just picking up on what Sam was saying there. I mean, Warren Gatland would have always, in a COVID-free environment, would have been looking particularly at away games and how players respond in these away fixtures, because ultimately that's where the Lions Tour was supposed to be played, in a hostile environment against the world champions away from home in South Africa. Now, because there's no crowds and because the Lions Tour is, in all probability, not likely to happen in South Africa, you know, you ask yourself, does that change, you know, the selection ever so slightly in terms, probably not massively, but there's not as much onus on performing, you know, under pressure in a hostile environment away from home. So, and I know that's a big thing for Gats. And just going back to the beginning, I mean, I was one of many people that were wondering whether how much more top class test rugby Alan Wynne-Jones had in him, you know, and maybe at the beginning of the, or around about Christmas time, I would have said, you know, maybe the likes of Itoje, you know, and one or two others have pushed ahead in the pecking order. But actually, I take a lot of that back. In fact, all of that back. I think he'd been absolutely magnificent. And even in the performance on, for someone who doesn't play huge amounts of rugby in between test matches, I mean, I'm staggered at how well he plays, because it almost defies what we're saying about Saracens players. You know, he has a way of work. He was magnificent at the weekend, and you know, he took responsibility. Some of the, you know, the work rate in terms of some of the tackles he put in, particularly on Billy Vunipola, who was looking, you know, somewhat a bit more dangerous than what we've seen previously. So yeah, for me, he's, I don't think there's any question he'd be the captain. I think it's going to take a massive performance. I think that just sealed his fate, really. I think he's been brilliant, and I just think it just goes to show, really, that you can defy your age and play magnificently. And I think he epitomises exactly what Warren Gatland wants.
Lawrence, do you not think that the flaw in what you said, I think you're probably right, but is not the flaw there that the best second row partnership by the time they get to Lions test matches might be Marrow and James Ryan?
Well, not on the evidence I've been watching.
I agree. Yeah.
I mean, James Ryan has not been playing well. You know, do you know how tough those second rows are in South Africa? And they got about 20 of them, by the way. they are seriously tough people, you know. And it could be the actual key to the whole tour. You know, who you pick in that position, quite frankly, because you know, they're absolute monsters, those blokes in South Africa. And you know, I wouldn't have any qualms about picking Alan Wynne-Jones.
I thought he was quiet in the autumn series, but I think the Six Nations, I think he's been brilliant. And even, it's just like, I haven't seen him lose his cool. He's just so composed, so relaxed. He's just so comfortable at that level now. It's even like bits of skill, like, you know, where Wales, they score points, they get ahead. England put a really high kick at kickoff, massive chase, and he goes up in the air, which I think is the hardest skill in rugby, by the way, is to collect a kickoff with a lifting pod, with eight forwards running at you, screaming, and you've got to get up, and he catches it above his head every time. That's like a real key moment. How many times have teams scored and then they receive kickoff, they drop the ball, they give, and then they just give the momentum back to the opposition? And I just think that we didn't hear him speaking to the referee that much, probably because it was subtle when he did it. And two, he goes about it the right way. And, you know, he's got 16 years of pro rugby under his belt now. Like, he just knows the crack. He knows the drill. He knows the crack. He knows how to treat referees. He knows what works. I think right now, and the way he's playing, like James Ryan and Mauro, who were brilliant going back last season and the season before, that they haven't been pulling up the trees that they have been. And I think Alan Wynne's definitely been the form second row of the Six Nations. So, yeah, right now, I agree with Lyle. I think he's front runner.
And I mean, you go to other players like Johnny Gray. Johnny Gray's another one who's been outstanding.
Yeah, he's right?
But is he big enough in the, you know, to play again? I mean, it's South Africa you're talking about. They've got absolute monsters, and that is such a key selection. And Gats knows that. You've got to partner people who are physically big enough and tough enough and strong enough to go toe to toe with the world champions.
The other game of the weekend gave Ireland a chance to register a win. It was the perfect weekend for them to play Italy after the way that things had gone for them in the first two rounds. What stood out for you guys? Sexton seemed to get a chance to impose himself a bit.
I'm a bit confused with Ireland, because everyone just needs to get off their case a bit with Andy Farrell. I think, you know, I don't know, I just feel like he, you know, ever since Schmidt's left, you know, it's kind of careful what you wish for. And then Andy Farrell's moved in, and I don't think anyone doubted the fact that he didn't deserve that, the opportunity to do that. But there's always been this kind of almost, I think there's more questions with them. And I don't necessarily think they're particularly warranted, really. I think he's got a bit of a rebuilding job to do there, you know, in moving the team around. He's got, you know, halfbacks that are coming to the end of their incredible test careers and could continue for a bit longer, obviously. So, yeah, I mean, I thought they put in a decent enough performance, really. 27-10 or 28-10 at halftime, I mean, against a, you know, poor Italian side. But Will Connors sort of stood out, really. I thought Caelan Doris was going to be the man of this tournament. You know, he was my pick, and obviously, you know, through concussion, and we wish him well on his recovery. But Will Connors has been a good one for them. And I think they're steadily improving, Ireland. They're getting better. I mean, obviously, the test will come, but a bit unlucky in a few games.
The best performance for Ireland at the weekend might have been Joey Carberry getting through 17 minutes at Munster. You know, as Lol says, there's all this pressure on Andy Farrell to change a team, but he hasn't really had a 10 to change to since he's been there. But,
well, not one he can pick anyway.
London Irish went pretty well over the weekend, yeah, again, didn't they? Well, almost becoming incredibly awkward, that, but Carberry could just about get him out of that problem.
I was going to say, on the subject of second rows, I know he might not have, he doesn't always play second row, but Tyburn is becoming a real top player for Ireland. And I've just always been super impressed with him. So I've known him pretty well from watching him and playing against him. He was at the Scarlets in Wales for a long time. And he was one of the key players why they won the league. Like, you know, you could probably single out three or four players which massively contributed them towards winning the Pro 14, going away and beating Leinster away. Like, he was magnificent. And he's gone back to Ireland. He's taken that form back with him in Ireland. So I think on the subject of second rows, yeah, Tyburn, you know, he plays with six in his back sometimes as well. I think he's been brilliant for Ireland. And I agree, like, you know, Ireland were one red card away from beating Wales. Then they lose to France, who are arguably, you know, the best team in the tournament. They put Italy to the sword, which you know, England didn't do at home. They went away to Italy. And Italy will always target home games massively compared to away games. So, yeah, I agree. I get off Ireland's back. They've got some great players. I think it's great that Carberry's back. I think it's the reason Johnny Sexton has been playing for so long as well, is, you know, he needs that competition beneath him to start coming through and playing regular. And I know a lot of his injuries as well. But, yeah, I think Ireland are looking okay. I think, yeah, I think people, they've got players there who are going to be there for the next potentially like two World Cups. So, yeah, they've got a good squad that they're going to build on. So Andy Farrell's, I think, in a decent place with Ireland right now.
In France, it's, I mean, who knows what's going to happen over when that game gets played. But Bernard Laporte, the French rugby president, has confirmed this morning that it was Fabien Galthié who breached the COVID bubble. He went to watch his son play rugby after the Italy game, the first game. And, of course, now they had to postpone the home game against Scotland. And the rugby calendar being what it is, I don't know how they see that game being played. They're not going to play it this weekend. So then it has to be played after the championship. And yeah, the word from France was they were looking at the summer, which would clash with the Lions. So it just, you know, A, France are in danger of blowing their own Grand Slam chances, if, you know, because Galtier may well face some disciplinary action. And B, for the championship, it would be an immense shame. I guess Wales can do them a favour by going on and winning the Grand Slam and at least solving the problem.
We're all enjoying, you know, this French renaissance in terms of you know, because it's been so long since France has been competitive. You can't break COVID protocols and then there'd be no sanction. So, you know, I think their chances of a Grand Slam are run, really. And I think anyone who thinks that they should be rescheduling that game in the summer is in cloud cuckoo land. You know, if your head coach and your leader decides to break COVID protocol, if that was a player, it'd be stood down for a couple of weeks. Josh Adam then invited back in. And I just think it sets a terribly conflicting precedent and wrong, really, if they're able to replay that game. I think they just have to accept, he has to accept as the head coach, the responsibility that he personally has cost France a Grand Slam. And, you know, it's a great shame, but they'll still, you know, they've still got a part to play in this tournament, you know, and I just think that's what should happen. I mean, of course, France will push for the game to be replayed as late as possible, but I don't believe they should be allowed to do that.
Before the Six Nations began, the chief executive explained that their intention would always be to to rearrange matches. He said use the fallow week, but rugby politics.
But rearrange for what? Rearrange for a couple of positive tests, but actually a breach of COVID protocol is a slightly different. And also, I couldn't. You felt for France because they wanted to celebrate the fact that they hadn't won in Dublin for a very long time. But even after the match, you could see Gaultier hugging his captain Dupont, knowing full well that he'd breached COVID protocol. So I can't really defend him in that sense.
Yeah, and so A, for disciplinary reasons, and B, I don't think it does anything for the championship to have one game moved to the summer, which could be a decisive game. Surely they have to step in and say this is a 28-0 defeat or 25-0 defeat to France and at least retain some integrity, but also send out a signal that France were fortunate to be involved in the first place, because the French sports minister was putting a lot of pressure on them to get everything right and looking at all the other countries and worrying about what the other countries' protocols are. And then it happened that the France were the ones who broke it.
What does it do to the whole French dynamic to have this happen? I mean, Josh Adams can blow it. And then, as you say, Sam, he can go out for 2 weeks. He's been a naughty boy, come back again. But if finally, it seems that, for the first time in a decade plus, France have got their whole situation, their coaching set up, everything was pointing in the right direction. But if it's your head coach, who we know is not the greatest man manager anyway, so I don't know how much the players love him, but they obviously play for him at the moment. But if he's the guy that's lost them a Grand Slam or a Six Nations, that must play havoc with relationships and confidence within the team, no?
Oh, it's got to. I'd be livid. If a player stepped out of line or a coach stepped out of line and cost you a Grand Slam, it's a tough one because you're coach and so you can't bite the hand that feeds you type thing, isn't it? But you'd be absolutely livid. And I think they should finish the Six Nations in the window that it's in now. I think it's getting messy trying to move things into the summer and beyond. It takes away from the drama. And I think it sets the precedent as well. You've got to realise how serious this sort of stuff is. And if an MP gets caught travelling around the country, they're getting severely punished. I think it's got to be the same, whether it's in sport as well. So, yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a massive fan of France. And I don't want to talk ill about them. I'd love to see a potential Grand Slam showdown on the last weekend, but this isn't a me personal issue with France, it's just a COVID issue, so I just think you've got to treat it as serious as everyone else.
Is it a sackable offence?
No, I don't think it is.
I don't think
it's a sackable offence. Look, he's just had sacrifices have to be made, and I'm sure there's lots of people that like to go and spend the weekend with their son or daughter or go home and see their family, but it's not what you sign up for, and unfortunately, he's had an error of judgment. And I think the fact that it would cost them the chance to play Scotland and potentially chance to win a Grand Slam is a punishment enough, quite frankly. But yeah. I can't see that decision being made any other way. I think it just sends out completely the wrong message to players, fans and anyone. If they say, oh, it's okay, you broke the COVID protocol, but don't worry, because you've won every game, we're going to give you a chance to win another one. I just think it would be the wrong message. And that's nothing personal. That's not a personal attack on Fabien Gaultier, who quite like the bloke, but I just think it's the wrong message, really. And I think France need to accept that, and they need to accept it quite quickly as well.
Is it an error of judgment? Is quite a nice way of putting it, Lol. I mean, there's a sort of arrogance in it, isn't there, to thinking, I don't have to follow the rule. I mean, it's not like he made a mistake. It's not like he wouldn't have known. He's made that decision.
Well, listen, once you've done that, I mean, I think you've got, he knew that he'd done that and yet continued to sort of celebrate with his players very, very closely. So, I don't think they can look any further than internally for the reasons why they're not competing for a Grand Slam.
I just go back to Owen's point about what does it do to the dynamics? And we know how strong the player opinion is within any French camp. And if they start turning against him, if he loses that element of respect, then the decision would have to be made, because Josh Adams misses two games, comes back in and plays. He's got a point to prove. If you're the head coach, you're setting the standards. And if you're the one at fault, then I would have thought it puts his position in under question, or certainly under scrutiny.
The way the French are, I think they just shrug their shoulders. He'll apologise to the squad and they'll move on. This project that he's talking about is not going to be derailed. Bernard Laporte will make sure of that. They're onto a good thing with the coaching setup they've got. you know, it is a big setback because, let's be honest, France haven't won a title for, what, 11 years now. And they probably should have won it last year, but they didn't. And this was their year. This was going to be their year. And, you know, maybe it would give them even more incentive moving towards the World Cup. But they're not going to get any worse as a rugby team as a result of it, I don't think. It delays their, you know, what should have been a pretty strong chance to win the title. And I think it just gives Wales a massive opportunity as well.
If Gaultier was to lose his job, then does that mean that Sir Clive comes in? Because he applied for that one, didn't he? We'd all love that, wouldn't we?
Did he actually apply for it?
I think he was invited to apply. He definitely had an interview. The French clubs then had a vote on whether they would allow a non-Frenchman to be the head coach. And they said, on no account will we ever allow a non-Frenchman to lead our team. So maybe he wouldn't get. Maybe they'd reject him again. But
I think the Six Nations have to make that decision this week. We're in a fallow week now. Everyone needs to know where they stand heading into round four. We should just sign off with our gods of the week.
You heard it here first, Alex. On St. David's Day, I can't nominate anyone other than Alan Wynne-Jones, really. I mean, I hope someone will say the Welsh coach as well, who's been under a bit of pressure. But I think on St. David's Day, for just a magnificent performance, for proving me and a lot of other people that there's still life in the old dog yet, I think Alan Wynne-Jones is my god of the week.
Yeah, I'm going to go for an unsung hero, actually, and somebody I know quite well. He's kind of just gone about his work under the radar amongst the Welsh coaching team. But I think since Gethin Jenkins has come in as defence coach, it's been the one big coaching change that they've made. Since I've left, they've been much better.
You've just signed the death knell to your coach.
But I think since Gethin Jenkins has come in, I've seen a real different appetite into the Welsh defence and their physicality in games. And I think he's had a really good effect on the team. So, it's slightly an unorthodox choice, but he's been sort of keep it young and put up for too much press. I know he doesn't like all that stuff. So he's just been there doing his work, certainly behind closed doors. But I think he's had a really good effect on this Welsh team.
So I was going to say Gethin as well. And rather than tip-tap round it and come up with something else clever, I'll stick with him. But the interesting thing there, Sam, was, you were there at the start of the Wayne Pivak era. He appointed Byron Haywood, and that clearly didn't work. And he took the tough call to replace him quite quickly. That really didn't augur well for his man management, his ability to talent spot as a coach, etc. It was a strange thing to go through. So the fact that he's made that change, he's gone to Gethin, and again questions were asked about whether he was right for the job, he was so inexperienced, etc. But he's gone to Gethin and it's worked so well. So I think that whole sort of mini chapter in the Welsh team development is really significant. I'm with Gethin as well, so you're outvoted on that.
I'll say Wayne on the basis that he's influenced all of those around him and he should enjoy his moment in the sun. I think Eddie Jones said that if the casinos were open, he should go and put some money on, go and play some blackjack, because he's on a roll. Well, he is on a roll, and credit to him. So I'll nominate him, and it's an all Welsh panel of nominees for God of the Week this week, and understandably so. Gents, thank you all very much for joining. It's been a great chat. To all our listeners, thanks for tuning in again. Please subscribe, like, rate us out of 5, all those things. And we'll be back next week to preview round 4 of the Six Nations.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.